forgot about it.
That's
quite a
live on the
road. It's a weird thing. Some of the cuts involved in the grand prosecution of that. Cut some of the data and not.
Look around you for the exits and instructions in terms of
evacuation and earthquake, not covered, et cetera. So please memorize the...
This is a good time to have this conference, I think, because there's a lot of interesting activity going on in a number of fields, and this topic is becoming actually more popular as far as conferences are concerned. I certainly know a few that have occurred recently, and I think what makes this conference a little different is that we have tried to bring together three major studies which have differences in detail. Science agencies would have similar kinds of issues with respect to large databases, which are becoming much more important. And for that, in that respect, I would like to mention the panel today, which will be an interesting exercise, I think, in trying to understand the implication of these large public databases, more and more public databases. And that's coming, I think, from pressure from the government and the state to make the data public, even that the data is enhanced by the public. So I think it will be an interesting discussion. So now I'd like to introduce to you my co-chair, Louis Hyens, who will also say a few words.
So, yes, I'd also like to welcome you to this meeting, and I hope this turns out to be an interesting and fruitful conference for you. I'd just like to sort of put it in perspective of some other conferences and workshops that I've been organizing, namely the FISTAT series of workshops. These started in the year 2000. Actually with two meetings, one at CERN and one at Fermilab. That was basically a particle physics, I mean statistical issues in particle physics, and in particular it just dealt with one specific topic, namely sort of when you sort of search for something and you don't see, you don't find it, you want to set an upper limit, how do you set an upper limit? I naively thought that if I organized a conference or two on that subject, then we solved the problem. The discussions about that topic still carry on. So as I said, the initial meeting was really for particle physicists. We had one or two statisticians, but then we sort of quickly discovered that statisticians are good people to have. And so future meetings that we had between 2000 and the last one in the series was 18 months ago. As the meetings went on, we tried to involve more and more statisticians and learn more from them and perhaps interest them in things that we were doing. The other thing that happened as well is that gradually we sort of got more and more involvement of astrophysicists and cosmologists. So this is the first time we've had one with photon science as well. We thought it would be great to have the three main topics that you have here at FLAC. So we hope we'll be able to learn from each other. Because we've got this sort of mixture of different sorts of people, sort of particle physicists, astrophysicists, photon scientists, and statisticians, I mean, it's a little bit hard to tell who's who. And so I devised this method by which I can determine which branch somebody belongs to. And what you do is you say to them, what is the value of H0? And if they say, well, H0 is the Higgs boson, and if you discover it, that's going to be a Nobel Prize for somebody, that's the value of H0, then they're a particle physicist. If they say, well, H0 is the null hypothesis, and you always want to test your data against the null hypothesis before you do anything else, they're a statistician. And if they happen to say the value of H0 is 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec, then they're an astrophysicist. While if they say H0, the sort of hydrogen atom that really is the basis of all spectroscopy, then they're probably a photon scientist. So now you know how to tell what your neighbours are doing, so you can say hello to them and find out what topic they're doing, what they're interested in, and maybe it'll even lead to a collaboration with them and some interesting interaction. So really, I hope you find this meeting valuable, interesting, and that it leads to a better understanding of dealing with these specific problems of how to deal with statistical issues that arise in searches for new phenomena. So thank you.
Well, our first speaker this morning is Ali Ekstrom, who's going to talk about model selection, estimation, and bootstrap smoothing. And you should all have a copy of this talk in your registration material. So, please go.
Oh, yeah, sure. Am I up now?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
The red one.
Yeah.
Oh. So I took off my sport coat to show the informality of the occasion. And as they said, they very nicely have put the notes in your folder too, so you can follow along. So it says, That's good. It says usually up there, and that usually applies to me. In my history as an applied statistician, some new data arrives. I've got a new problem somebody wants solved. I look at the data, rather informally, I choose a model for the data. Maybe if it's a simple regression, I might choose linear or quadratic or cubic somehow. And I choose quadratic. I fit the estimates using the chosen model. And then I analyze the accuracy of the fit as if I'd pre-chosen it. And I ignore the model selection. And, of course, that can be dangerous. These days, statisticians are beginning to be interested in including the model selection in the accuracy estimation. And the reason they're getting interested in is modern computational equipment is good enough so you can make some dent on that problem. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today, effect on standard errors, confidence intervals, et cetera, of model selection. And I'm going to give two examples. It's a bootstrap kind of theory, and there'll be a non-parametric bootstrap and a parametric bootstrap, and that'll include the two examples. So both of them are quite simple examples, incidentally, with small data sets that make things clearer. So here's the cholesterol data. This goes back to the 1970s. 164 men took cholestyramine for 7 years. Cholestyramine was one of the first drugs for lowering blood cholesterol. And the men, incidentally, were doctors, male doctors. And the two things were measured, how much they complied with the regimen, that is, how much of the stuff they took, and it ranged from 0 to 100%. And that was X. And then Y, the thing that was really interesting was the decrease in blood cholesterol between when they started and when they finished. And they, for here, today's talk, I'll talk about the regression, estimating the regression of Y on X. And more specifically, if you call mu J, if you call mu J the expected value of Y given XJ, that is the expected number of cholesterol measure per person J, Dr. J, that's what we'll be interested in estimating. So here's the 164 data points. The y-axis is the cholesterol decrease, so big values indicate the drug worked well on the person. Low values indicate that it didn't. X is the compliance measure, and I've adjusted the made a transformation so that X is just about normal, 0, 1. And I fit a curve to it. Green curve is a cubic regression. Ordinary least square is cubic regression. And as I said, usually then what I would do is fit the, to find out how accurate that is, I'd use the usual ordinary least squares formulas going back to Gauss for a cubic regression. But today we want to include the fact that we chose the curve by a statistical method also. So what method did I use to choose cubic? Well, I used the CP selection criterion. I start out with the ordinary least squares regression model, y equals x beta plus, call it e, I should have said epsilon. I'm going to assume the e's are have mean zero and fixed variance sigma squared, where I know sigma squared. And if I was just doing least squares, I would take... fit beta hat to minimize y minus x beta hat squared. And if I do that, that's fine for if I have my model x in mind. X is an n by m structure matrix. Each of the m columns means something. Beta is the unknown parameters. And I would just, the bigger model I chose, if I chose a bigger x matrix, I'd do better quotes because I'd have I could always come closer to Y. So that doesn't do much for model selection. And the CP criterion adds a penalty to M sigma squared, where M is the number of columns, the degrees of freedom, and the sigma squared is this variance that I assume I'm knowing. And then beta hat, so beta hat the OLS estimate for that X, and M is the degrees of freedom. And from the idea of CP model selection is from possible models X1, X2, X3, it chooses the one that minimizes CP. And in fact, that's what I did to choose cubic. Then you use the ordinary least squares estimate from the chosen model. So here's what CP gave. Model 1 linear, it has 2 degrees of freedom for the intercept and the slope. Model 2 quadratic has 3, model 3 cubic has 4, et cetera. I went up through 6, with model 6 with 7 degrees of freedom. The last column shows the CP values. I've subtracted 80,000 from each of them, so it's easier to look at the numbers. And you see that the cubic one minimizes with a sharp minimum. That's how I chose cubic for my picture that I just showed you. And incidentally, I took sigma equals 22 from the biggest model. As I said, usually, that is in my previous 50 years as an applied statistician, I would have just been happy to use the usual formula for the accuracy of a cubic regression. But today, I really would like to take into account the fact that I went through this CP business to choose the cubic regression. So I'm going to do a non-parametric bootstrap analysis. The original data consists of 164 pairs, XI, YI. And they gave the original estimate vector mu hat equals X3 beta 3 hat. That vector mu hat is all 164 estimates. And I'd like to take into account that 3 there is database 2. It's not just beta hat. I perhaps should put 3 hat there because it was chosen randomly too, or by some elements of randomization. So that's where the non-parametric bootstrap comes in. It says data star. That's the bootstrap data set. I draw from the 164 pairs, I draw 164 times at random with replacement. So subject 1 might came up twice, subject 2 not at all, subject 3 once, etc. And now I have a new data set, data star, and I go through the same business that I went through in the first place. I use CP to choose the degree, M star, which might not be 3 this time. It gives an ordinary least squares estimate, beta hat star, M star. It gives an estimate of vector mu hat star equals X M star, beta hat star, M star. And I did this all 4,000 times. And so that's why the classical statisticians didn't deal with this problem, because they couldn't do it 4,000 times. It would have taken their entire lives. And incidentally, 4,000 is excessive. Probably 400 would have been plenty, but it took almost no time to do it. Here's what happened. What did I happen? I missed one of the... Oh, yeah, I meant to say, in this picture, I'm going to choose the red dots are the five of the 164 doctors that I'm going to use just so I can make displays with 5 instead of 164. And in particular, this doctor here, the worst complier of all, will be featured. That's subject 1. Okay, so I did the whole bootstrap thing of sampling, applying CP, getting the estimates. And this is a histogram of the 4,000 estimates for subject 1. And the curve, the histogram looks sort of like a lopsided normal histogram. The black line is the original estimate for that doctor, 2.71. And at this point, this is when I first got a hint that things weren't going to be so easy as I thought. The estimate is not near the center of the distribution. As a matter of fact, it's at the 76th percentile. And this, I've got a lot of experience with these things. This never happens. And the reason it never happens previously to me is that usually I didn't include model selection in the reproduction. If I just had done this for the model, for the cubic model, the black line would be right at the center or very close to the center. What this brought out to me is the fact that model selection estimates can be quite jumpy. As you move, you have to imagine the space of possible vectors of 164 numbers or 164 pairs, and that's a complicated space. And various places in the space, you choose model 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc., and small changes can move you across a boundary. And as you move across that boundary, you get a discontinuous change in the estimator. And that's bad for setting confidence intervals, say. And here's what happened for either box plots for the for subject 1 estimate. The model that was actually chosen, model 3, it happens for that subject, model 3 gives consistently larger estimates than model 1, 2, 4, 5, or 6. The red curves, the red bars, are how many times out of the 4,000 that model was selected. Model 3 was selected about a third of the time, But models 1 and 5 together were selected more than a third of the time. So the model selection is not very steady in this case. It's jumpy, and you can see it. Just moving the data a little bit, you can easily move into a different regime. Okay. So question, how does that bootstrap confidence intervals or confidence intervals in general in this situation? And the easiest standard thing to do is just to use the point estimate. Oh, I'm going to say 95% confidence intervals just to have a fixed number. Point estimate plus or minus 1.96 times the standard error estimate. In the for this histogram, the standard error, the standard deviation was about 8.02. That's how much the bootstrap variance was. Bootstrap standard deviation was. And the trouble with this works reasonably well in non-model selection problems. It's quite dangerous in model selection problems because that mu hat that you're centering things at, it bounces around. It's jumpy. It goes up and down. And so if you move just across the boundary, suddenly your confidence interval moves a lot. A second way to proceed that's actually better, the percentile method, use the 2.5 and 97.5th percentiles. In our case, order the 4,000 bootstrap replication values. We're still talking about subject one. Take the 100th one and the 3,900th one and use that as the limit. And that has the advantage of not requiring a middle. You don't have to pin down a middle for the interval. And that is a good deal more stable than the first method. The third method, and the one I'm going to talk about more, is to try and cure the jumpiness. That is, instead of using mu hat, use a less jumpy estimate, mu tilde, and then go back to the original things. And that has some advantages. The final thing I won't talk about until I get to the parametric case, and I still have time. Here's the 95% approximate bootstrap confidence intervals for subject one. On the left is the one I call the standard method, centered at that jumpy estimate, and it could have easily moved up and down a lot. Here's the percentile method, and here's the one that I said is the smoothed estimate that we're going to talk about, which in this case is considerably shorter, which is good, of course, if the shortness is justified. So where did I get the smooth estimate? So the idea, which has been in the literature, is here what I'm calling Y, vector Y, you can just think of as all the data, the 164 pairs. What I'm calling T, you can think of as the procedure that gives you the estimate. In our case, for the example we're giving, doing CP and then doing ordinary least squares. And in this, and for the examples I just given, then reading off the height for subject one. And the idea of bootstrap smoothing is to just take the average. We actually got 4,000 bootstrap data sets. Each time we got an estimate, take their average. So this is model averaging. If you will, or also known as bagging bootstrap aggregation, and it has some advantages. And one advantage, and the reason Leo Grimman was interested in it originally, is it reduces variability by averaging. You get a smoother, get a less variable estimate. But the reason I'm particularly interested in is it makes the it removes discontinuity. Now, the smoothed estimate does not change radically as you move across boundaries. Things are all smoothed out. And so we're back in a case that's more amenable to standard confidence interval method. But there's one obvious disadvantage to doing this. It took 4,000 cases to get one S of Y. if I'm going to bootstrap that to get its estimate of its variance, do I have to do 4,000 ones every time? And that would be, even for a modern computer, might be a lot of work. Fortunately, I wouldn't bring this up if the answer wasn't, no, you don't have to do that. There's a way to get around it. So here's this little theorem allows you to use the original bootstrap data to get an estimate of standard deviation for the smoothed estimate. So now I've made my notation simpler yet. I've called S naught the smooth function for the original data. I've called Ti star the estimate for the I bootstrap replication of the unsmoothed estimate. And the crucial thing here is yi star is the number of times the jth data point appears in the I bootstrap sample. So that could be 0, 1, 2. That's a binomial kind of thing. It might not be. It might be 2. It might even be 3. It probably won't be more than that. And cove j is the bootstrap covariance between ti star and yi star. And I didn't say that very well. Yi star j is the number of times the jth data point appears in the I bootstrap sample. So what this is the covariance between these bootstrap replications you're getting and how many times the various points appeared in the bootstrap sample. It's a measure of influence of the various points. And the theorem is that the delta method, that is the local linearization standard deviation estimate for S naught, is SD hat, the root mean square of the covariances. So the 164 covariances in this case, you square them, add them up, and take the square root. And the covariances you get almost immediately because you already have everything you need for that from the original calculation. And the other point about this theorem is that this is always less than the bootstrap standard deviation estimate for T of Y. So this indicates that you are saving something in terms of variance. The theorem is basically a projection theorem, and this is a schematic. T star is supposed to be the vector in 4,000 dimensions, and the space L of Y star is supposed to be the linear space spanned by the 164 bootstrap counts. And the theorem says the long line of the hypotenuse is the bootstrap standard deviation for the unsmooth estimate. The projected length is the estimate of standard deviation for the smoothed estimate. And what this says is the more nonlinear the estimate is, the more you save by doing smoothing. And since model selection estimates can be quite nonlinear, that's good to do the smoothing. The red curve here is the standard deviation of the smoothed estimate relative to the original for those five subjects. The guy I've been talking about most, subject one, this number is about 68%, so you save quite a bit in terms of standard deviation. The little light green curve is the naive standard deviation if I just had taken my cubic curve as given instead of taking into account model selection. And you'll notice that at the ends it's just about 100%, but in the middle, for subject four, we're down below 50%. That is, if you ignore model selection here, you're over optimistic by a factor of two. So model selection is important to take into account. I think we all knew that, but it's nice to actually see it happening. Okay, that was the non-parametric bootstrap example. And for the parametric example, this is the most important data set in the universe, according to the people who gave it to me, because it has to do with the cosmological expansion and supernovas and stuff like that, and it has to do with the fate of the universe. so we better get this right. The data consists of 39 pairs, XJ, YJ, J equals 1 through 39, where YJ is the absolute magnitude of a type 1A supernova. And these supernovas are, these 39 were ones that were close enough so that you could get their absolute magnitude without, from, quote, standard methods. But the standard methods fail when the supernova is too far away, and we also have some extra data that wasn't used in getting the Y. XJ, a vector of 10 spectral energies. And the goal of the study was to better predict the absolute magnitudes from the XJs. The idea being that if the supernovas are very far away, which is the ones they're interested in, where you can't use the standard methods, you could use a regression model to actually adjust. The theory was that all type 1A supernovas were equally bright, but people knew that wasn't actually true, and you can get some, you can get further, get the cosmological expansion more accurately if you could figure out the adjustment for the Y. And so the full model, the obvious one to use, is just Y, that's a vector of 39 numbers, equals X, that's a 39 by 10 matrix, one row for each of the 10 XJs, and beta, some unknown vector that we're going to find, and E, and I've set things up so we can take the EIs to be normal 0, 1. And the full model isn't bad here. Y, normal of 39 dimensions, X beta I. That I is the identity, and that's because I set things up that way. And the ordinary least squares estimates, mu hat OLS is just X beta hat OLS, where the beta hat minimizes the sum of squares. And it looks like it's pretty good. I'll show you in a second the graph. The naive R squared, the correlation squared between the predictions and the values is 0.82. But that's I said naive. It's naive because we've actually fit 10 parameters to 39 data points. The adjusted R squared is 0.62. That subtracts from R squared 1 minus R squared, M over N minus M. M was 10 and N was 39. Anytime you have a degrees of freedom, you can make this kind of adjustment, and it's important to do. Here's the 39 Y's plotted vertically. The horizontal one is axis is the ordinary least squares prediction, and this is the thing that has 0.82 as the squared correlation. But we know that's optimistic. The red points are the five cases I'll talk about more. So we have to do so the hope is that by the full model is going to be relatively unbiased, but it might be too noisy because there's a suspicion that some of those 10 values, the predictors, aren't necessary and maybe should be eliminated from the prediction, and then we would have less noise. We'd have smaller degrees of freedom and a better prediction. So how to make that stick? How to make a choice? Well, the Lasso estimate, is popular in statistics these days, you choose the beta hat minimizing the sum of squared errors plus a constant, which I'll talk about. Let's just think of it as constant now, times the L1 norm, the sum of the absolute values of the betas. By using the absolute values rather than, say, the squared norm, this has the nice effect. All the estimates are shrunk down toward to zero, but some of them are shrunk all the way. Matter of fact, usually a lot of them are shrunk all the way. As a matter of fact, if you make lambda very big, all of them will be shrunk to zero. If you make lambda zero, you'll just get the ordinary least squares estimate where none are shrunk to zero. And an interesting thing about the last two is that the degrees of freedom M is the number of non-zero beta hat k. So you don't have to do an elaborate calculation to figure out the degrees of freedom. Lambda and M are in one-to-one correspondence. As lambda increases, M decreases. And the model selection technique is to choose lambda or M to maximize the adjusted R squared. I can do the adjusted R squared because I know M, and then choose the mu hat equals X, the last two estimate. This is not a least squares estimate, no. Even the non-zero ones are shrunk some towards zero. Anyway, the last two is incredibly popular in the statistics literature right now. Here's the, I haven't given you the whole table, but here's part of it. Starts out at the top, lambda 63. It gives just one M. I forgot which one it is of the 10 variables. The naive R squared is 0.17. The adjusted R squared is 0.12. You start making lambda smaller, you get M bigger. When you get to 7, the adjusted, that is, 7 non-zero betas out of the 10, the adjusted R squared is 0.73. That's the maximum you get. And finally, if you go all the way, you get to 0.62, as we said. So the Lasso method would choose the 7th, the model with M equals 7. So now we're in the situation where we can do the bootstrapping again. That is, I want to figure out how accurate my fitted model is. I'm going to do bootstrapping. This time, I'll do it parametrically. The original data, Y, that's the 39 numbers. We can think of the X as fixed because we don't change that. Gave M, which actually happened to be 7. Then the last two estimate, beta hat M, and then mu hat X beta hat M. The full model parametric bootstrapping from the full model, which turns out to be important, we use normal 39 mu hat OLS I. That gives the Y star vector, the bootstrap data vector, then gives us a model selection value M star, beta hat star M star, mu hat star. And I did this all 4,000 times. Again, probably 10 times more than I had to. And then, having learned my lesson before, I did the average. I'm going to call T star IK the I bootstrap estimate for the K-th supernova. And then SK is the average of those 4,000 TI star Ks. So I have now 39 SKs. And there's a once again, if we want to get the standard deviation estimate for the K-th one of those, you don't have to bootstrap the bootstrap. You don't have to do brute force. The delta method standard deviation for SK, there's a similar theorem. Looks a little different, but it's actually about the same. Again, it's always less than the bootstrap estimate of standard deviation for TK. And again, it's a projection kind of theorem. You don't get as big savings here. I was a little surprised. I guess model selection with the lasso isn't as jumpy as the first thing I was doing. The savings aren't huge in this case. On the standard deviation savings, like 0.89, 0.95, stuff like that. On the other hand, the smoothing is very important still because it does keep the estimate from jumping around. The green curve here, these estimates are based on the delta method, which is a local linearization. You can go further on this. The green curve uses a non-local, non-linear form of bootstrapping, the bootstrap I'll discuss next. So Suppose we wish to do bootstrap replications of the smooth estimate SK, and the original one took 4,000 replications TIK star to get a single value SK. A brute force approach to bootstrapping SK would be to do a second level of the bootstrap, each time having to do 4,000 times more. And that sounds, as I said, that gets impractical, especially if the in situations with big data sets where it's harder to do any one. But suppose I do want to bootstrap the bootstrap. Am I stuck? No, you're not. There's important sampling method that, again, allows us to finesse the second level of bootstrapping, and it involves reweighting the original values. In schematic terms, Y gave our TI star I K 4,000 replications for supernova K for 4,000 bootstrap replications gave SK the average. And the reweighting scheme, which isn't, I'm not writing it down here, but it is not difficult. You generate weights from the data, which are easy to compute, and then SK star is the weighted sum, weighted average. And so to get a bootstrap replication, all you have to do is generate a new set of weights, which is almost instantaneous, and you can do that easily. And as a matter of fact, that green curve was from 1,000 second level bootstraps each time done with the reweighting, so it took almost no extra time. It's a little more favorable to averaging. And at this point, I'm going to just wave my hand. I'm going to tell you that you can get better confidence intervals than the ones I've been talking about. The smooth standard intervals and the percentile intervals have coverage errors of order 1 over square root of n. That is, that 95% may be 95% plus or minus some constant over the square root of n. And square root of n goes to, doesn't go to, one, C over square root of n doesn't go to zero very fast. The ABC intervals, this method, have errors of order 1 over n. And they involve correcting for things I haven't talked about, bias and what I call acceleration, the change in the standard deviation as an estimate varies. And again, by reweighting carefully, you can get this almost for free. So I did this for the supernova data and didn't make much difference. The black curves here are the ABC intervals for subjects 1 through 3, 4, for supernovas 1 through 5, each time I've centered them at the original point estimate. And basically, and the red ones are the smooth standard intervals. And except for subject 3, supernova 3, didn't make too much difference here. Might make more difference in another context. I've said something about brute force, as if brute force was a bad thing. Brute force can sometimes be a good thing if you're feeling brutish. And I actually wanted to, all of this methodology was designed to avoid having to do a second level of bootstrapping in order to assess the statistical properties of the smooth estimator. However, I did want to do at least one brute force double bootstrap in order to check how well my method was working, because the approximations involved some approximations, and I wanted to see how it was going. So I actually did 500 second-level bootstraps, each time with B equals 1,000 instead of 4,000, and each time I did my ABC method, and I calculated what the ABC method said was the confidence level for the interval minus infinity, the one-sided confidence interval that ended at SK, the original data estimate. and by the Neyman construction, if my method was perfect, my 500 would be uniformly distributed. That's what it means for a method, a confidence interval method, to work exactly. And it didn't work exactly, but it wasn't too bad. These are the five, except I ran out of room on the page. So the first four of those supernovas, and the this is the histogram of the 500 second level bootstraps. How what it was assigning to the original data point, and they should be absolutely flat if the thing worked perfectly, except for noise, and mostly they're pretty good. I was relieved that they weren't grossly off. So I just got a little sign that said 10 minutes, and this is embarrassing because I'm nearly through. So let's see, do I know jokes or anything? No. The last two pages are references and include other methods of taking a model selection into account and setting standard errors and confidence intervals. And so there has been some interesting other work. The first of the references is a method, conservative frequentist method that is guaranteed to cover the interval. It's not exact, it's too big, but it has the advantage that it works whether or not you knew the way, the method that you were using to choose the model. One thing I sort of snuck in on you is the fact that you have to know, in order to do the bootstrapping, you have to know your model selection technique. And very often in a complicated situation, that's hard to keep track of. There's some stuff on bagging and things like that on the ABC intervals. That's the story. And the bootstrap method, which is pretty simple, basically seems to work pretty well. And I've given myself a strong talking to and say the next time I have an example to do, I won't be lazy. I will take model selection into account. So thank you.
Thank you. It's very nice and clear talk. Do we have any questions?
Frequently, as we collect more data, we discover that our models are inadequate, and we have to go back and select them again. As you collect more data, you may find that models don't work anymore. And you have to go redo the model selection step. So how does one worry about, say, bias in picking the wrong model early on and then having a more refined model later?
Well, the theoretical answer is that somehow you have the past data and the current data, and you have some big model selection method that you've employed tacitly, and if you can take that into account, you can apply these things. But that's likely to be the console of perfection. All I can say is that taking model selection at least into a little bit of account is a big help over not taking it into account at all. And so in that case, with the bigger set of data, you'd fit a new model and maybe do the kind of analysis I was suggesting. And you might worry that you're underestimating the variability still because of past work. Good point, but I don't see it.
What's the relationship between the reweighted bootstrap and boosting?
Reweighted bootstrapping and?
Boosting.
Oh, boosting. Boosting is another method for model selection, and here I'm applying the reweighting later, more closer to the end of the analysis. The boosting might be a complicated model selection method, numerically quite similar to what I was doing, but with a different purpose in mind. And I might have done a boosting estimate for my examples, but I didn't have one there.
So you've described this CP model selection and the lasso model selection as generalizations of least squares.
Say that again, please.
When you described the CP selection criterion and also the lasso, I mean, they were basically generalizations of the least squares.
Yes.
But you got an extra term. So, but what if you have a problem where your data is not Gaussian, so you don't want to, you wouldn't use the method of least squares necessarily. You'd have some sort of more complicated likelihood function. I imagine that you could use these, you could write down something like the CP model selection or lasso selection based on a more general likelihood.
Yeah. So I made life easier on myself and the audience by using simpler examples. In theory, of course, none of this depends on being able to have theoretical closed form solutions or anything like that. It wouldn't matter if you had a completely different kind of data set and a different kind of fitting method. What the crucial thing is that you can do the recipe of how, for a resampled data set, how the model selection is done. And that can be a very complicated thing in a situation like the search for the Higgs particle, where they've been working for months or years, and the model selection was done, as the previous questioner said, sequentially. But as I said, even taking model selection at the current level in hand is often very, I think, important. But it's a good point. I maybe should have used a more exotic example. I didn't have one.
In your first example, certainly, the model selection consisted in just how many terms of a particular form you took.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes, for example, in the Higgs search, we might be trying to fit our background with one functional form and then try some other functional form. I mean, extend to changing the functional form as well?
Well, the second example was more like that. I just said how many terms were chosen each time, but they weren't the same. If I chose five terms, it wasn't necessarily the same five terms each time. And so the models had different feeling. The spectrum stuff at the lower end of the spectrum was chosen sometimes, some of the higher. So this is, again, in line with the previous question. This is a simplified situation, but there's nothing in the methodology that requires a simplification, only in the pedagogy of saying it out here. So that's the advantage we have. So an interesting fact is, why isn't there all this stuff from classical statistics that, you know, ordinary least squares goes back 200 years? I think almost exactly this year, as a matter of fact. And Fisher and all these guys. Well, you just can't make much progress on these problems with math alone. And we have the computers to do it. And so maybe I've misled people by talking about familiar methods here, because they don't have to be familiar in order to use this technology.
Any other questions?
You may have to help me.
Good question. If the model selection is perfect, that means the black box, you know the black box. Does that mean that for the bootstrapped sample, the selected model should not vary so much? Then, if you did your bootstrap and you see the model selection process is jumpy, when you do model checkings, you should check for the standard you choose for the model selection, or you should check for the, you take your model selection standards and just to say, I should use the improved, smooth bootstrap standard deviation estimate. I mean, when you do model checkings, if you see your the standard deviation estimate and the mean estimate is jumpy, whether you should change your model selection standard like the model CP, you replace it with Lasso.
Well, there's a lot of algorithms you go through of how to get to a good estimate. If you did what you just said, then the basic method would be more complicated than if you went to bootstrap it, you'd have to take that complication into effect each time for each bootstrap sample. And so and of course this can become impossible rather quickly. There's nothing wrong with your suggestion, but again, the main point is that you have to know the algorithm you use to choose the model in order to analyze it with these methods.
So it doesn't have to be perfect in this process, right?
No, of course not. And these standard error calculations or standard deviation calculations are usually quite forgiving. They're much more forgiving than, say, bias calculations or things like that. So, yeah, the models are likely to be wrong. The method is not likely to be perfectly encapsulated in what you say. But just doing this is a lot better than ignoring it, or at least can alert you in the case that I showed for the first example. Ignoring model selection could easily give you a false standard deviation half as big as you should use. And so that's something you should learn, you should know. And just doing a little of this, I did 4,000, a couple hundred will probably tell you usually if you're way off.
Any other questions?
Not this. Thank you, speaker, again.
Thank you. Let me get this out of your way.
Speaker is Roberto Rota. He's going to talk about dogs, non-dogs, and statistics, Bayesian surfaces as well.
Everybody, thanks to the organizers for inviting me to talk about progress on statistical issues in cosmology and astrophysics in general. Since this is a cross-disciplinary meeting, I thought I'd start off by giving you a little bit of an overview about what we call the cosmological concordance model. Then I'll go through a number of known dogs that we're looking for in terms of anomalies and searches, that's to say non-Gaussianity, non-trivial topology, generic departures from predictions from the Lambda CDM concordance model. And at the end, I want to discuss a little bit of cosmological take on principle Bayesian model selection. After some questions, hopefully we'll have some input on from statisticians and other people in the audience by the end of the gathering of the 3 days here. So at Imperial, we are kind of trying to push the astrostatistics side of things. We just opened the Imperial Center for Inference and Cosmology with the new director, Alan Heavens. So we're very excited about this collaboration between statisticians and cosmologists and astrophysicists. In fact, here you see arguably our most famous alumnus, Brian May, opening the center a month ago or so. And in case anybody doubts it, here is there's no question as to which side of this statistical debate most of us lean on in our field, as I'm going to explain later in my talk. So the cosmological concordance model is based on what we call the Lambda CDM. Lambda stands for the cosmological constant, and CDM stands for cold dark matter. Two of the main ingredients of this concordance model is not quite a standard model in the sense of particle physics. It's based on three main pillars. Inflation, the idea that in the first time to the minus 32 seconds after the Big Bang. It was a period of exponential expansion that was powered by a yet unknown scalar field, the inflaton field. Still on the notion of dark matter, a component, possibly a new type of particle, which we looked at in various ways, which needs to be massive, neutral, non-baryonic, that makes up about 25% of the universe. And I believe that Jan is going to talk about more about it later today, so I'll let him expand on searches in terms of dark matter. And then the third pillar is dark energy, which powers the accelerated cosmic expansion, as demonstrated, for example, by Titan A supernovae. And this is a yet unknown field, smooth field, with a negative equation of state that makes up about 70% of the energy density of the universe. And the thing to notice here is that all of those things are yet unknown, so there's lots that we're looking for. In the next 5 to 10 years, we have lots of observational data that are going to elucidate many of those issues, or so we hope. The fundamental assumptions around which the concordant model revolves are listed here, that we have statistical isotropy and homogeneity, that is to say, on sufficiently large scale, the universe on average doesn't depend on the observer's location and the properties of the universe statistically do not depend on the direction that you look at in the sky. So that's one of the fundamental assumptions when you write down the general relativistic metric that describes expanding space-time in for three barometer Walker universe. However, that's an assumption, so one needs to check whether this is the case or not, and there are models where there are anisotropic universes or cosmic bubbles or other non-trivial topologies, for example, that can violate this assumption. People are looking for this kind of anomalies. Another basic assumption is that the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background sky, which I'll describe later, are well described by almost perfectly Gaussian distributed fields, which again is the case in a simple model of inflation, but there are models that actually violate these assumptions. And again, looking for non-Gaussianity can be a smoking gun for those kind of models. A diabaticity of initial conditions is another fundamental assumption, namely to say that after inflation, all types of mass energy in the universe inherit the same statistical distribution of fluctuations in the sky. And again, there are other types of models that violate this assumption. And in general, in astronomy, astrophysics, and cosmology, we're looking for anomalies, these fundamental ideas that we point our telescope somewhere in the sky, and then we look for something there that doesn't quite fit expectations. And that's something interesting. That's the way the field has progressed in the past, many times, say the cosmic acceleration, the supernovae, or the cosmic microwave background discoveries and so forth, those are all serendipitous discoveries that cannot be predicted from theory because we don't have a fundamental theory in many ways. So one of the most important data sets that we use is the now full sky map, such as this, of the cosmic microwave background. This is the relic radiation from the Big Bang in a microwave regime. What you're looking at here is a temperature map by the WMAP satellite. Red spots are hotter regions and blue spots are colder regions, and the temperature fluctuations on this map are at the level of 10^-5. So there's very small temperature fluctuations that encode in a statistical way a wealth of information about the cosmological parameters that we care about. So, anisotropies are a mixture of physical effects. Some of them arise from initial conditions, from inflation, from the very early universe. The statistical distribution of fluctuations is inherit the perturbations in the very early universe. There are temperature and potential fluctuations that are superimposed at the moment of where those photons were decoupled, 380,000 years after the Big Bang, 13 billion years ago. And then there are line of sight effects, again, temperature fluctuations or temperature changes in the photons as they travel from the last capping surface where they originate to us through the universe. And what we see here is sort of a superposition of three different layers. The way to statistically analyze this is to make a spherical harmonic decomposition on the sky here, and delta T over T in the direction N on the sky can be decomposed in terms of spherical harmonics. And then you look at a two-point correlation function between two different spots in the sky, and assuming isotropy and homogeneity, this can be written like that with no dependence on the M direction, in the sky, the zenithal direction, only dependent on the multiple number L. This quantity, or the C sub L, is the so-called angular power spectrum, just the expectation value of the square of the ALM on the sky. And if you further assume that those temperature fluctuations are almost Gaussian, then the two-point correlation function, or equivalently, the power spectrum here contains the full statistical information. So that you know, this C L then encode all information if the fluctuations are Gaussian. If not, then you have to look at higher-order statistics. There's information in there, too. How well does this theory work? Extremely well, to an extent. You can see here measurements from the WMAP satellite in black and other ground-based telescopes here all the way to a multiple number of 3,000. You can see the simplest seven-parameter lambda CDN concordance model fit, which is extremely good. As you can see, we can fit thousands of multiples with only a six-parameter model, which contains dark energy, dark matter, but nevertheless, it's an extremely good fit. You can see also the temperature polarization correlation power spectrum, and again, the fit is extremely good. You can see this is far away from a white noise spectrum. It's not a featureless power spectrum. It's got characteristic oscillations here, which are called the acoustic peaks, the physics of whom is very well understood. In fact, what we're looking at here is light that travels all the way to us from the last cutting surface. So in this diagram, we are sitting here, sort of the center of the diagram, so looking back along the line of sight, along those lines here, the sort of the outer shell here is the Big Bang, T equals zero. For the first 380,000 years, the universe was hot and highly energetic, so the hydrogen was ionized, light did not propagate, and after 380,000 years, the temperature dropped sufficiently for hydrogen to recombine. That's when the photons from the microwave background were released. This yellow circle here represents the so-called last cutting surface. That's where those microwave photons come from. And they've been redshifted by the expansion of the universe by a factor of 1100 from emission to when we pick them up now at the temperature of 3 Kelvin. And there's a simple way of understanding the structure of this power spectrum that I showed you, the peaks and troughs here. What they are the reflection of cosmic sound waves in the early universe. So we have overdensities of matter in the early universe and underdensities due to the initial perturbations in the distribution of energy density in the inflationary field. And those perturbations in the matter energy density, they create waves of matter that propagate, expand outside the third of the speed of light. From an overdensity here, you've got waves of perturbation moving out until gravity reverses the motion and so brings the wave back in. Then when the wave starts to collapse, photon pressure starts pushing out. So you've got standing waves that get set up in the universe, and they are reflecting them now in the power spectrum of the CMB. Those acoustic oscillations are really acoustic waves in the early universe that we see. We understand this very well. We understand it to the point that we can also see the same pattern of acoustic waves in local, relatively local distribution of galaxies. Here you see the southern and northern cap of the Sloan-Digital Sky Survey, which has gathered thousands of galaxies, hundreds of thousands of galaxies in 14,000 square degrees of the sky. And what you do, you look at the correlation function between galaxies now at a much lower redshift, 0.35 compared to 1100 for the CMB. And what you see here is the correlation function, the two-point correlation function, is a function of galaxy separation. You can see that it drops with distance. It's hitting a rock buffer here. It drops with distance, then there's a blip here. There's a peak at the separation of 100 megaparsecs, 150 inverse megaparsecs if you hold in the Hubble constant. And that signature here is essentially the same signature as the cosmic waves in the microwave background, but now imprinted in the distribution of galaxies at much lower redshifts. So this is called the baryonic acoustic oscillation peak. And what that gives you is a cosmic ruler to measure the expansion of the universe. So we measure the acoustic scale, the acoustic waves in the early universe in the CMB, as I showed you before. The very same acoustic waves have left an excess of galaxies, an excess in galaxy correlation at 100 megaparsec separation. So on average, we're looking for one extra galaxy on average at this preferential separation, which corresponds to the peaks in the propagating sound waves in the early universe. And so because it's the same characteristic scale, the same wavelength, effectively, that we measure at 1100 and a redshift of 0.35, this acts as a ruler, a cosmic ruler, by which you can measure distances in the sky. If you do so, you end up with a measurement of the acoustic scale as a function of redshift. You can see here different models for the expansion of the universe containing different matter and energy content give you different laws for the acoustic scale. And this here is a CDM, lambda CDM model with an error bar. And the red here is what you would get for a universe where the dark energy is not a cosmological constant. And the blue is what you get for a universe which is actually curved, slightly curved and not flat. So we can distinguish these different models using this kind of combined data sets putting together as well supernova measurements, such as the ones that Brad was talking about before. So if you put it all together, this is what you get in a space where you describe the matter content of the universe, the cosmological content of the universe, where one is the amount of energy density that you need to make the universe especially flat. So you end up with measurements from the cosmic microwave background here, and the brilliant acoustic oscillations there, from the supernova data here. When you combine them all together, you end up with this universe with 70% cosmological constant and 30% matter. And if you look at it in this plane where you have matter density, the matter parameter, and the equation of state of dark energy that describes what kind of dark energy you have, end up with something very close to a cosmological constant W cos minus 1. So that's kind of the backbone of what we mean by a cosmological concordance model in a nutshell. In cosmology, though, most of our work is Bayesian in nature, maybe because of computational advantage, maybe because of philosophical implications, maybe because we like the idea of probability as degree of belief. In fact, this shows that the number of Bayesian papers on the archive in astrophysics rises much faster than the total number of papers. So you can see that normalized to 1980s levels, the number of astrophysics papers doubles every 25 years. So double your effort of reading the archive goes up by a factor of 25 years. The number of Bayesian papers doubles every 5 years or so. If you project this into the future, by 2042, all papers on the archive will be Bayesian. That's based on the rise in terms of methodology and way of interpreting those data. So I wanted to talk about some of the ways we can deviate from this concordance model and how people are looking for deviation from this kind of vanilla model that I described. So non-Gaussianity is this notion that we are looking for deviation from perfect Gaussian distributions and temperature fluctuations in the CMB. So single field inflation, namely the notion that inflation was powered by one single scalar field, predicts that those temperature fluctuations from the sky should be almost perfectly Gaussian distributed. So if you can find, if you can prove non-Gaussianity, then we have a smoking gun signature for non-standard physics in the universe, for example, multiple scalar fields at inflation. And so the primordial curvature perturbation that parameterizes deviations from perfect smoothness, as it were, in the universe, can be written as a field, a Gaussian field, which is Gaussian distributed in linear theory, plus a second-order perturbation theory term, which is the square of that field, with a parameter in front, which we call the FNL, or nonlinear parameter, that sort of dials up non-Gaussianity. And here is to give you a feeling, so this, think of this as a Gaussian field. This is just a square of a Gaussian field. That's a 1D example where you have the solid line is a Gaussian distribution. And then if I dial up FNL to 1,000 for the second order perturbation, you get the dashed line, which is quite close to the solid one. And 5,000 gives you this light dashed line, which is a little bit off the Gaussian distribution. So you can tell kind of the difference between Gaussian and non-Gaussian by eye here. However, the kind of non-Gaussianity levels that would be interesting for cosmology are much lower. The primordial FNL from inflation is 10 to the minus 2. Line of sight effect gives you an FNL of order 10, perhaps. Extragalactic point sources give an FNL of 2. So you need very small numbers that we're looking for in terms of deviation from Gaussianity, if at all. This is what people use. One of the methods that people use to look for non-Gaussianity, there are several, looking at the bispectrum, wavelet, genus statistics, and so on and so forth. There are different methods that people are trying to look for these non-dots. We all know what Gaussianity means, but what does it mean for this distribution to be non-Gaussian? There are several different ways it can be non-Gaussian. One of the most popular ways of looking for non-Gaussianity is to use the bispectrum, namely to look for the first-order non-Gaussian the non-Gaussian contribution to the temperature fluctuation is the three-point correlation function. If we look at a three-point correlation now in Fourier space and we average it over the whole sky, if you assume isotropy and homogeneity, it means that this function here is only a function of K1, K2, K3, only of the modulus of the wave vectors, not a function of their direction. And furthermore, if you assume isotropy, the three wave vectors need to be connected in such a way that they form a triangle. So there's a delta function here. So in fact, the bispectrum, this function here, you can think of it as a two-parameter family of functions where the two parameters that define the shape of the triangle. And because of homogeneity, you rescale the triangle by factor alpha, just rescale the overall bispectrum. So the bispectrum is really just a function of the triangular shape that you choose in K space. There are different types of triangles. There are an infinite number of triangles you can look for. So there are three different triangles which are mostly interesting for cosmology. The equilateral triangle, the squeezed triangle where one of the sides is much more than the other two, the flattened triangle where one of the sides is pretty much the sum of the other two. There's actually a theorem that says that for the squeezed triangle configuration, the bispectrum from single field inflation is always small, more than 10 to the minus 2. So if you look for bispectrum in the squeezed triangular configuration, you can find it, then you have a generic signature for non-Gaussianity in the early universe, a generic signature for departure from the simplest lambda CDM paradigm. So here's what a non-Gaussian temperature map would look like, again, because the temperature fluctuations are function of the primordial curvature fluctuation that I described. There's a transfer function in front that can be computed very fast nowadays with a Fasten Boltzmann integrator. This is a Gaussian sky with F and L equals zero. That's a non-Gaussian sky where of course the phase of distribution has been enhanced with an extremely large F and L. So again, we're looking for an F and L which is over the one, if at all. And so that's going to be a very challenging search, especially because those map simulations for the physical reality have to deal with point sources, sky maps, and all sorts of experimental effects like beam asymmetries. People have been looking for FNL different from zero by effectively developing maximum likelihood estimators and trying to estimate uncertainty using often Gaussian approximations to the full distribution because of computational issues. The fully Bayesian treatment is presently unavailable because of computationally intractable issues that arise if you try to model this from end to end in a Bayesian way. So point estimators have been used. In 2008, Yadav and Wondolt claimed a 99.5% confidence level detection of non-zero FNL, a detection that went away in the meantime with better data. In the latest release with WMAP 7, we have limits of order a few tens or a few hundred on different configurations of triangles. So here's an example of one of those searches that generated lots and lots of attention, and then went away with better treatment of the data, with better experimental understanding of how the beams of symmetry of WMAP work and so forth. And now we only have limits that will be improved by a factor of 5 next year when the Planck data are released. Another interesting search in cosmology is for non-trivial topology, namely the idea that we might live in a universe that is not simply connected. If space has got a non-trivial topology, then light from distant objects can reach us from different directions in the sky. So the idea here is a two-dimensional torus universe, just for fun. You have a galaxy here, so the light from this galaxy can reach us directly like this, or it could go around the universe and reach out from the other side with a different redshift. So it's useful to look at this by looking at a fundamental cell of the torus, namely just a square with opposite sides identified. So you can look at this thing by imagining that you are here, and then, you know, if the universe is a torus, a two torus, then you get the same light from a galaxy from this direction, from that direction, and from that direction. So that leads to the notion that there should be multiple copies of objects on the sky, possibly with different orientation and possibly with different redshifts. So you're looking for copies of objects on the sky if you want to prove that the universe is not simply connected on field of topological space. So this is what some of those ideas look like in terms of fundamental cell in 3D. So here just identifying opposite side of a cube. That was kind of an artist's impression of what multiple copies of an object would look like in the sky. This works for a flat spatial manifold. This works for an hyperbolic space, tiling it with this kind of fundamental cell. This works for a spherical space, tiling it with a dodecahedral fundamental cell with opposite sides identified. So now, in cosmology, the way you look for non-trivial topologies by looking at the most distant visible object in the sky, namely cosmic microwave background, which is the most distant visible object that you can see. So the idea is that we sit here, as in the previous diagram, with the microwave background fluctuations coming at us from all around us from a distance of 13 billion light years. And if the fundamental cell is smaller than the cosmic microwave background distance to us, replicate the fundamental cell across the plane, and then replicate copies of observers and copies of the microwave background, it turns out that the last coupling surface here, if the fundamental cell is sufficiently small, will intersect at points in 2D, and in 3D, intersections will be circles. So the idea here is that we're looking on the cosmic microwave background sky for matching circles, that to say the same fluctuations coming at us from different directions in the sky, possibly with phase differences and possibly with parity differences as well, in order to prove that the fundamental cell is smaller than the last coupling surface. And then you can find that you found a universe that is logically non-trivial. It's quite a neat thing. There are other motivations as well for looking for non-trivial topology, namely the fact, I don't know if you've noticed when I first showed this picture, that a large angular scale, to say small multiple moment, you notice that the quadrupole L equal 2 is kind of small compared to the best fit lambda CDM model. And this thing here has attracted lots of interest when it was released by WMAP in the first year, because one of the possible interpretations is that the universe is not sufficiently big to sustain the large K mode, so the large wavelength mode that contribute to L equal 2. So this is large angular scales on the sky and are mostly seeded by a very long wavelength mode in the temperature and isotropy. So if the universe is smaller than those wavelength modes, then the power in this mode is cut off, and therefore you expect a lack of power here, and therefore this could be a sign of non-trivial cosmic topology. The most recent reanalysis of this shows you what is effectively posterior PDF for the value of the quadrupole. You see that it peaks at a lower value than what the model would like, but the value of the model still has a tail probability of 18%. So actually, WMAP team claims that this value is not that anomalous after all, and it's nothing to be too worried about. So in order to look for matching circles in the sky, people have used several tools again. One of them is this circle comparison statistics, X, which depends on alpha, the aperture angle of your circle, and the relative phase of the two circles that you're looking for. You're looking in two different directions, A and B in the sky, and you look at the correlation function between the temperature and isotropies in location A and location B, averaging along phi, the angle described in the circle, possibly with the phase difference between the two, then you normalize by the variance, by the sum of the variance. And so this test statistics here picks up for a given relative orientation of the circles, picks up as a function of the aperture angle alpha, the matching circles by giving you spikes, high values of the test statistics whenever the two circles match. And if there is no matching circles in the sky, then you see only noise, which doesn't pop above the detection threshold. It has been applied to WMAP full sky map, and the results are here. You can see that there is no significant deviation from expectations for no matching circles case. So this leads to constraining the scale of cosmic topology to be above 24 gigaparsecs in WMAP 1, and most recently above 28 gigaparsecs. That's about it, because there's nothing else beyond the cosmic microwave background that we can use to test for even larger scales. That's the most distant object. However, anomalies in the map have drawn lots of attention, and the problem here is that none of those things were predicted. This is really one of these quintessential astronomical cases where you point your telescope in the sky, you see something strange, and you go, oh, wow, that's strange, and how significant is that? Very difficult to quantify. Of course, as people start looking for anomalies, those anomalies kept popping up, especially in the large scale temperature distribution. Here you can see the WMAP map with the quadrupole and octopole components only, and people have started noticing that, for example, how strange is it that the ecliptic plane neatly divides the power in the quadrupole and octopole right in the middle, and there is an excess of power down here compared to the northern hemisphere. And then if you look at the direction in which the different multiple vectors point, for example, the red and the green are the directions associated with the L equal 2 and L equal 4 multiples, L equal 3 and L equal 3 multiples, they're exceedingly close nearby, they're correlated, and so forth. So people are starting evaluating p-values for different coincidences that exceed in the large case chi. But however, it's very difficult to assess whether any of this is due to chance or whether it's just a look elsewhere effect, whereby people are starting looking for this kind of anomalies and found them. If you look for enough of them, you'll find very significant values from the point of view of the p-value calculation. Other anomalies include large-scale cold blobs in the southern sky that do not appear to show up in the northern sky. A very cold spot down here, which is, again, very anomalous in Gaussian fluctuation. And the emission for Stephen Hawking in the sky, there was a point made by the doubling up team saying, oh, that's just a Lukasher effect, right? I mean, here it is. What's the significance of that? The current consensus, at least from the WMAP-7 collaboration, is that there is no problem with those anomalies. It's all sort of a posteriori statistics. And the quadrupole is statistically consistently random. The quadrupole is within the 95% confidence range. No significant anomaly in the large scale. The quadrupole and octuple components are remarkably aligned. It may be due in part to chance. That's a nice one. While this alignment appears to be remarkable, there was no model that predicted it, nor has there been a model that provides a compelling retrodiction like that. The hemispherical asymmetry is not statistically significant, and there has been a confirmation using bipolar power spectrum analysis here. There has been a confirmation that the quadrupole power is strongly asymmetric from the northern and southern hemispheres, so it's a very strong many sigma deviation from isotropy. However, this is due apparently to actually a residual beam asymmetry in the experiment that hasn't been calibrated properly. So nothing cosmological to worry about, despite the flurry of papers that try to explain it in terms of fundamental physics. So the bottom line of what I'm trying to say is that in cosmology there is a sort of standard model that people use, the lambda CDM, as a null hypothesis of sorts for which we look for deviations and anomalies. So if we use the concordance model as a minimal sort of model with the minimal assumption, single field inflation, Kriemer-Rommertz Walker matrix, general relativity, dark matter, cosmological constant, and then we start looking for things that deviate from this minimal set of assumptions, the generic predictions. Some of the generic predictions are listed here, and the searches that have been done so far have turned out to be not significant for many of those. So initial conditions are adiabatic within 10%. The spectral distribution fluctuations is a featureless power law within 5%. Gaussianity is okay within the limits of the current constraints. Gaussian energy is a cosmological constant within 10%. The curvature is zero within 1 per mil. Some modern gravity waves haven't been found yet. Even if they are there, they might be too small to be detectable. Consistency relation between the luminosity distance and the angular diameter distance predicted by the Kriemer-Rommertz Walker cosmology is okay within 20%. There have been tantalizing deviations, for example, from the number of neutrino species in the universe, which now shows a 2 sigma deviation, which for particle physics in the audience is nothing more than laughable matter. So a little bit more than 3 neutrino species in the universe, according to the latest CMB. Data. Statistical isotropy should be there, but those anomalies make the issue a little bit more unclear. Non-trivial topology non-found within 29 gigaparsecs. The neutrino mass, which we know it's out there, we only have upper limits so far from cosmology. So the current status is that this lambda CDM provides a remarkable fit to a large variety of data, and searches for anomalies have been largely unsuccessful. Now I want to spend the last 10 minutes, talking about how we could approach this in a more principled way or not by looking at it from a Bayesian model collection. So the Bayesian take on this is that we kind of unify searches in terms of general Bayesian inference in this three-level scheme of things where you do level one inference where you have selected a model M and you have a prior for the parameters of that model theta. You're interested in the favorite value of those parameters by looking at the posterior distribution for them, assuming that M is the true description of your data. But actually, of course, many scientific questions are of the model selection type, and searches and anomalies are one such question. And we want to when we want to assess the relative plausibility, different models, different possible estimations, model 1, 0, 1, etc., in the data, for the data. And in the Bayesian sense, the interesting quantity here is the posterior odds, namely the ratio of the posterior probabilities for the two models given the data. The third level of inference, we can even try and do model averaging by averaging over all the models that we know about in order to get posterior inferences on the parameters that do not depend on our model selection. I'm going to briefly mention this at the end of time. So model comparison is arguably the way of approaching many scientific questions, from astroparticle physics to cosmology to astrophysics. All questions of detection are perhaps best phrased in terms of model comparison. Often nested models are the framework, so we have a baseline model with no effect, and the new effect that we're looking for shows up as an extra parameter and non-zero parameter in an alternative model that we want to compare with a null model. So in order to do this in a Bayesian sense, very briefly, because many people in the audience here are experts, well, the relevant quantity is the model likelihood, what we call in cosmology Bayesian evidence. So the normalizing constant here at the bottom of Bayes' theorem, which is just the average of the likelihood under the prior for the model M of interest. And once we have the evidence, which is the probability of the beta given the model, we can invert it to the posterior for the model given the beta by using Bayes again. When we compare two models, we take the ratio of the posterior probabilities like this, and this is just given by the ratio of the evidences times the ratio of the model prior. So the relevant quantity here is the Bayes factor, the ratio of the evidences for the two models under consideration. So the Bayes factor gives you the amount by which your relative degree of belief in the two models a priori, C0 and CM1, have changed in the light of the data. So if I give you the Bayes factor, you can plug in your relative initial degree of belief, you can update your relative degree of belief to the posterior odds via the Bayes factor. Of course, the technical problem is that the Bayes factor is a possibly high-dimensional integral of the likelihood of the prior, so this might be a difficult thing to compute numerically. However, we've developed some strategies and algorithms in recent years that have given us a very good handle on this. I'm going to briefly mention it just in passing later. From the point of view of how to interpret the Bayes factor or the Bayesian evidence, it works like this. Here is a toy model, a one-dimensional toy model. We have a parameter here that we're trying to estimate, and we can compute the evidence of the beta given the model. That's the average of the likelihood under the prior. If the likelihood is much more sharply peaked than the prior, that's approximately the maximum likelihood value, and the typical width of the likelihood times the prior at the maximum likelihood value. But because the prior is a PDF, it needs to be normalized. So this number here is roughly proportional to 1 over the width of the prior. You get this result here for the evidence. That tells you the evidence is made up of two different elements. One is the maximum likelihood value here, the quality of fit of your model. Obviously, the better the fit, the better your model. But equally, there's a second term here to call Occam's factor, is the ratio of the width of the likelihood to the width of the prior that penalizes models that are poorly predictive, models that have a large prior, a wide prior, poorly predictive parameter space, get penalized by this Occam's factor, and therefore, in terms of Bayesian model selection, balances out quality of fit with predictivity. Now, of course, this is problematic in a sense because the prior inference never goes away. You know, the width of the prior is set the strength of the Occam's razor factor, and therefore you better know, based on physical or principal considerations, how to set your prior, because differently from inference, the prior never goes away in Bayesian model selection. We have two nested models, such as the ones that we often encounter. For example, if we're trying to determine whether a parameter is non-zero, we need the extra parameter in our model. Then we can compute the Bayes factor between the model 0 with no free parameters and model 1 with one extra parameter, just like this in a simple Gaussian example. So you have your simple model predicts that certain parameter is 0, and you go out and measure the parameter to be theta at, that's your maximum likelihood value, let's say. And then the Bayes factor between the two models is given by this factor here, which is again the Occam's razor, which penalizes the more complex model. This factor here is always positive because delta theta, capital delta theta, is always bigger than small delta theta, being the width of the prior. This is a positive factor, and a positive log of the Bayes factor gives you an evidence in favor of the simpler model. And that factor here, where lambda is the number of sigma deviations from your prediction, this factor here is always negative. It is, it gives you how many sigma you have detected your model. So if you have detected your model at many, many sigma, this number is large and negative. The log of the base factor is negative, and you're favoring the more complex model, as you should. So the best model is the one that balances out these two factors. So one way of looking at this in this two-dimensional plane where I'm plotting the base factor for nested models as a function of lambda, the number of sigma significance of your detection everywhere, as a function of the information gain in the log of that of this prior to posterior or prior to likelihood width. You can think of this axis as in this direction, for fixed data, you are choosing a wider prior, so a less predictive model. Or in that direction, for fixed prior and fixed sigma, you are getting a larger sample, more data. Okay? And so what you see here is that if you have a large number of sigma detections, 4 or 5 sigma, then you're almost invariably in this blue region here where the extra parameter is required with increasingly large odds. And so that's fine. That's what we all know, that a 5 sigma detection is a detection. And so Bayesian model detection agrees with that. But a 2 sigma detection, kind of lost in having cosmology, is almost invariably not a detection because you don't even get, for any choice of prior and any data set, you never hit the blue region with 2 sigma. If anything, if your model is very unpredictive, the simpler model is favored. This region here is the region where actually the Occam's razor effect dominates, and the simpler model is the best explanation for your data. And so, obviously, where exactly you land in this plane depends on your choice of prior. It's important that you know how to set it in the prior case, that's the strength of the Occam's razor. Now, of course, in terms of Bayesian model comparison, we assume that we have a model to compare with to begin with. Sort of going with James, who said that there's no point in rejecting a model, rejecting a null hypothesis, unless there's a better alternative. And so we always have to have some sort of at least straw model comparison model to have. Still, we should check whether or not our Bayesian inference in terms of model selection is robust with respect to reasonable choices of prior. Sometimes the prior is not well determined or not well defined. There are cases where model selection works very well in astrophysics. Here is one example. Object detection is a case where Bayesian model selection performs exceedingly well. Here's a mock data set showing a sky map with a number of sources confounded by Gaussian noise. There's a number of sources here, and the task is to identify how many sources there are and where they are, and the number of sources is a priori unknown. Obviously, there's one down here, probably one over here, and difficult to see in the noise. Here's the signal. You can see where the sources actually are. Here is a Bayesian reconstruction using a model selection approach that correctly identifies 7 out of 8 sources. And the reason why those two have not been identified as a single source is because they're very weak and close by, so they get bundled together in one source. But that's a very impressive reconstruction. If you look at the sort of the posterior distribution or the log likelihood, if you prefer, with the flat tire, look at the scale here. The difference in the strength of the sources is massive, 300 orders of magnitude, and yet the detection of 7 out of 8 sources is still successful. And that works very well. Here's another example where we look at a cluster detection from Sunyer's Zaldovich effect in the cosmic microwave background map using interferometry observation. So here the question is whether or not there's a cluster in this map in the presence of background, noise, and point radio sources, all of which needs to be characterized by the map. That's a simulation. Again, this is the case where there's no cluster. This is the case with the cluster. Of course, by eye you can tell. So you have to run a Bayesian model comparison procedure. You look at the posterior odd for the two models. So now you have one model where you have a cluster in the data and a model where you have no cluster in the data. So in this case, the posterior odds are 3-1 in the favor of the no cluster hypothesis, correctly, because there's no cluster in here. When there is a cluster, then the odds are 10 to the 33 in favor of the cluster hypothesis, correctly. All at the same time characterizing position, temperatures, and profile of the cluster all in one go. There are examples where Bayesian model selection really works usefully in, for example, in object detection. Just briefly, you mentioned the algorithmic way, how this is done in some of those applications, a very successful algorithm developed by Ferris and Hobson in Cambridge, and we've used it for a number of searches and other work. called multinest. I don't have time to go into the details, but I'm happy to talk to you about it. It's a very efficient way of sampling posterior distribution. You can see here a very challenging example of samples drawn from a posterior distribution that looks like two cylinders. Very challenging for MCMC, reconstructed with very high accuracy, with a very good efficiency, up to 30 dimensions. And here is a case of a mixture model of Gaussian, computing the evidence with multinest. It's within error bars, it's the correct evidence, it can be computed analytically, and it takes about 100 times less likely evaluation than thermodynamic integration. So it's a very successful argument that gives you the Bayesian evidence, the model likelihood, but also can sample multimodal likelihoods in a very efficient way. So all of these tools have been applied in a number of ways in cosmology. There's a summary table that I compiled some years ago to show you, I don't expect you to read this table in detail, but it shows various extensions to the Lambda CDM cosmological concordance model that have been analyzed using the Bayesian model selection framework, and all of those numbers are negative, which means that the log of the base path is negative, and so the Lambda CDM model, the concordance model, is the minimal model that is successful in describing the data. There is no evidence in the Bayesian sense from extension, for extension to this model. Now, one problematic, and finally to conclude, I wanted to try to problematize the use of Bayesian model selection, especially in cosmology. Here is an example that Bob Cousins was talking about a couple of years back at the another such meeting in Banff, where he was saying, well, actually, there are cases, like, for example, search for axioms in cosmology where the a priori available parameter space spans orders and orders of magnitude, and there is no way we can set a meaningful metric or a meaningful prior on a parameter space that spans orders and orders of magnitude. There is no way we can describe perfect ignorance or our state of belief or the degree of belief in a theory a priori in a meaningful way. So there isn't a relevant metric, and whatever you get out of the Bayesian model selection framework or whatever prior you pick is going to be meaningless. In fact, there are many cases such as this. For example, inflation is one case. Particle physics, there are cases like this where the extra unknown parameters are really unknown, and so there is little or no guidance from the fundamental theory as to how to pick a meaningful prior for those alternative models. And so the concept of total ignorance does not have any precise meaning. In fact, what people do in this case is they look for deviations from the minimal model by using parameterized models. And so just eschewing the formal model selection set at all, just looking for significant deviations from the null hypothesis. So the Occam's factor in these cases can be arbitrary. But one of the possible point of view is that if your model doesn't give you a prediction for a parameter, a range that's physically meaningful, then your model isn't good enough. Simply you don't have a handle on your physics, which is sufficient to give you a physically motivated range for the prior. In some cases, the upper bound formulas can be useful, which has been used and developed by Jim Berger and collaborators. Here's an example where you essentially, what you do is in this example, you change your prior, you dial your prior in certain categories of cases, you can change your prior until you hit the maximum of this curve that gives you the preference for the extended model, and then you put that number here. So this number here is essentially the maximum evidence in favor of a model, of the more complicated model, maximizes over a whole range of prior within a certain prior category. And so if that value here is not strongly significant in terms of the Jeffrey scale, for example, then you can claim that no other choice of prior within that family of priors will give you a more significant detection for that parameter, and therefore you can conclude that that parameter is generally not needed. In general, the Bayesian framework, even using this upper bound approach, is much more conservative with respect to p-values, for example. So a 2 sigma with a p-value of 5 in this upper bound formally translates into evidence of 3 to 1 at most for the extra parameter, and even a 3.6 sigma translates into evidence of only 150 to 1. So in general, the Bayesian framework is more conservative, and the rule of thumb is that an n sigma result, an n sigma p-value result, should be not taken down a notch. It's an n minus 1 sigma result in reality, which is kind of a useful way for us in cosmology to think about things. Finally, one more thing I want to mention is this notion of model averaging, as I conclude, just to say that we try to get we prefer to take a step further and average over possible models on the table to get parameter inference that is independent of the two models. So we try this approach by looking at the curvature of the universe. Here is a model average posterior distribution for the curvature parameter of the universe. And here you see an interesting effect, which is we're averaging over flat models, open model, and closed models, because we don't know which one is the truth in the universe. And because the flat model is actually favored by the data, since the observations agree with the flat universe, we get a concentration probability effect, a spike here, which is a reflection of the fact that the posterior probability for the flat model, which has got omega curvature equals zero, is higher than for the other model. And so model average constraints on this parameter, omega curvature, can be actually stronger than non-model average one because the concentration probability, we gain a factor of 8 in constraints after model averaging, for example, in the number of Hubble spheres in the universe. So model averaging can take on board the model uncertainty, but also can give you stronger constraints on some of the parameters because of this concentration probability effect. And that's an interesting thing that can take you one step further in the inference. So to conclude, in astrophysics, often searches are poorly defined. We have a concordance model that defines a null hypothesis of sorts. The motivation for searches is often to just go out and look for deviations from this, even in the absence of well-motivated alternative models. There's no question that once you have found a deviation, then there's going to be a flurry of papers written by theorists on the archive the next week, claiming that they understand where this is coming from, even though it might not be real. Detection, almost invariably detections, quote-unquote, are at the sensitivity limit of our experiments. There are large, poorly controlled foregrounds and backgrounds, poorly understood systematics. Instrument is often insufficiently characterized at the beginning of the mission, low signal to noise, small number statistics. All of that means that often these detections are at the limit of what can be done. And anomalies are deemed to be worth publishing roughly at the 2-something sigma level, which is shockingly low, especially for the particle physics kind of community. The scale of deviation from the null model are typically unknown, so we don't know what we're looking for. We don't even know what order of magnitude we're looking for. And therefore, for Bayesian model comparison, often prior selection is impossible, if not meaningless. Too many anomalies, such as Gaussian anomalies, for example, non-Gaussian entities, go away with time and better understanding of the experiment. Is this perhaps a evidence that the community jumps on flukes too quickly? Rigorous hypothesis testing is often avoided just by when you look at how many sigma away our parameter is from zero, and that's our detection sort of reporting. Often people simply ignore the conditions of validity for Wilks and Chernoff theorems by reporting chi-squared values and p-values for cases where they cannot use them. An important philosophical point is that no repeated experiment is possible for many phenomena, such large-scale CMB anomalies. We cannot draw the universe a second time except in computers, so it's difficult to assess the significance of the anomalies that were not looked for in the first place. Model selection is, in a Bayesian sense, is, in my opinion, desirable, but often impractical. It would be interesting to see whether there are other ways of doing searches in a Bayesian way that do not rely on the a priori specification of an alternative model. I've got more questions for the statisticians. I'll leave them up. One more, if I may, just one that I'm really interested in discussing with people during this 3 days conference, is how do we deal with limitless paradox, namely when frequentists and Bayesian methods disagree, and not just in the searches case, but something that I think Jan will talk about this afternoon, what do we do when frequentists and Bayesian methods disagree, even at the inference test? I mean, all statisticians I talk to always tell me, well, you have to look at both. And then, yes, but if they disagree, what is the scientific conclusion? If my profile likelihood half-length intervals are different from my Bayesian posterior credible intervals, widely different in some cases, and I have no better data or no data too expensive to get, what is the scientific conclusion of my experiment? That's a nagging open question that I would really like to get an answer for. And I conclude by a sort of a different look of what searches in astrophysics are nowadays. Just go out and look for a dog or something, and that's what we need by searches. Thank you very much.
So we have time for a couple of questions before the break.
Going back to around your page 20 or so, you had a slide about the WMAP saying that the there was no anomalies. All right, yes. How exactly did they conclude that it was statistically insignificant? As you pointed out just now, there's only one universe, one sky that we can look at.
Well, exactly. So the only thing you can do then, once you've found the anomaly, then the only thing you can do is you Monte Carlo your sky, not putting in all the physics you know about, in this case, the Lambda CDM model, and putting in all the best characterization of the detector that you have, which has evolved with time with the WMAP case, that they understood better the low, the symmetry, and things like that in their receivers. They put this into the modeling. And then all of those things are essentially based on p-values that have been obtained from simulations of the sky, putting in the physics you know about, and then looking at this actually the value of the test statistics for the observed data and determining tail probabilities. That's the way they did it. Which might not be satisfactory in many ways, because of course you can only put in your simulation what you know about. Right? If you're missing a key bit in your simulation, the test statistic distribution might not be accurate. That's the way they did it.
Any other questions? So if you do model averaging, what is the physical interpretation of that?
Right. So, for example, in the case of curvature is quite a good case because you model averaging, because the three different models that you're averaging on are well defined. You know, if the universe is a field of topology, then you only have three types of metrics. So flat, closed, and open with three discrete parameters, one discrete parameter with three different values distinguishing between them. So while you might want to say, well, actually, I want to model select the best answer for what is the true model, you might want to make a model average constraints on the free parameter of the more complicated model, in this case, the curvature parameter. The physical interpretation of this would be to say that this PDF, this posterior distribution, takes into account the fact that the flat universe is preferred by the data, but of course there is always a probability that this is not the correct model, and so this sort of edges against the fact that it's an open or a closed universe, and the limits that you get by looking at the posterior 95% intervals of the model average posterior are limits that do take into account both the model averaging and the uncertainty in the choice of the correct model. So in that respect, the physical interpretation is nothing more than saying, well, actually, this averages of all possible physical alternative models within this class of models for spatial detection. Whether this tells you anything more about what you care to know about, which is one of my questions, is the model averaging useful? Actually, is that something that we should be doing? Or is it something that adds an extra layer of statistical sophistication where
So we have a break now until 11:15.
11:15, yeah.
Let's thank the team again.
I think that's good. Thank you. Please stand by.